The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
My next guest joined on Garda Síochána during a period of relative calm in the late 1960s, with crime at a historic low and the threat from subversives having dissipated over the preceding years. But the following decades would be filled with much upheaval as policing was changed as much through politics as it was by events. A Question of Honour, subtitled Politics and Policing, The Inside Story, is a memoir of the author's experience within An Garda Síochána, but it also tracks the force's development over the last 50 years and how very often the politics of the day influenced the way that the Garda force could do its job. Retired Detective Chief Superintendent and author of A Question of Honour, John O'Brien, is joining us now. John, good morning and welcome.
Pat, good morning to you and thank you for the opportunity.
Now, this is a massive book. I didn't even know where to start with it because there are, well, it's decades in the making in terms of your experience, but it covers so many things. But there's one event that I can go back to because I was there on the night, and that was, I was there for a period on the night, let's put it that way. That was the burning of the British Embassy in 1972.
Yes, indeed, Pat, a remarkable night for a whole lot of reasons. Just let me put one contextual point, if I may, to start. Is next year is the centenary of the foundation of the Garda Síochána, and this book chronicles the last 50 years of that centenary. So that's kind of the context for what I'm doing. Going back to 1972, of course, the burning of the embassy followed on Bloody Sunday in Derry the previous, the 2 days or 3 days previously. And it was the first time that you could say dramatically the Northern Troubles had reached Dublin in such a way. And of course, emotion was tremendously high. And it is probably unknown in civilized societies that a embassy of a country, even one that we had various feelings about, would be burned down.
I remember the night in question, like there was a crowd gathered around it who were not bent on setting it on fire. And then a truck arrived with people on board who were armed with petrol bombs, and they used the protection of the crowd so that they could fire the petrol bombs at the embassy. And that's when I left, when I saw what was going on. No,
exactly.
It wasn't cowardice. It was disgust, to be quite honest.
That's exactly right, Pat. And there are two photographs in the book that capture that moment very well, where you see the guards in a semicircle around the front of the British Embassy in Merrion Square. And I was one of those guards, and whistling over our heads were petrol bombs and rocks and various missiles. And as you were there, you'll remember one of the key things is that when this sort of riot develops, the noise is absolutely incredible. So in terms of communication between myself and my colleagues, and I was a young guard, and I was lucky I was a motorcyclist, and that meant I was wearing a helmet, and I got a rock straight down on top of that helmet in the course of the event. And of course, the burning of the embassy took place about over 3 days. The Monday, obviously, then Tuesday, and eventually burned on the Wednesday. But the key thing from my point of view, looking at it professionally and then in subsequent years, looking at the lessons to be learned, as a police service or a police force, we were not organized. We turned up as a crowd, and the other people turned up from their side. And, of course, then the rest was, because emotion was tremendously high. Mm. I mean, I think I say in the book, Pat, that a young red-haired girl from Derry got onto the back of the lorry you just mentioned, and she sang them in behind a wire. And you could feel the hairs on the back of your head stand up. So nobody is there as a kind of an impartial observer, cool and detached, you know. So there's a lot of fear, a lot of fright. But, of course, it is totally wrong that in any country that an embassy would be burned down. Although, later, in many years, there was a reconstruction that said we exercise, and I always smiled when I heard this, masterly inaction. In other words, by doing nothing, we achieved a lot. In political terms, I can understand that. In policing terms, of course, you know, we should have learned the lesson, and we had the same event in 1981 when there was an attack on the newly built British Embassy on the Merrion Road. And again, the tactics were the same from our point of view, i.e. a large crowd of us and a large crowd of them, if I can put it that way. And the key lesson to be learned, and you would have seen it in the January 6th attack on the Capitol in the U.S., is As a police tactic, you must maintain physical distance between yourselves and the rioters or the crowd. That way, hand-to-hand combat is prevented. There is minimum damage on both sides. People who are there to make a legitimate protest can do it. But that tactical approach has to be to provide this kind of airspace path between both sides. That way, we don't get involved in this brutal face-to-face and hand-to-hand combat where injuries occur, and, of course, the whole thing deteriorates into a terrible riot. Mm.
Now, these were terrible years because we can go back to the Dublin and Monaghan bombings in May of 1974, and people were killed. And in a sense, that's an unfinished chapter, because again, when politics intersects with policing and with public mayhem like this, sometimes the answers are very hard to get to.
Absolutely. And the again, when the Dublin and Monaghan bombings took place on the 17th of May 1974, the context for that was that there was a new power-sharing executive, the first one of its kind, which had been introduced in Stormont. And there were widespread strikes and civil disobedience in the north. And on this particular day, the 17th of May 1974, three car bombs were exploded within the Dublin city centre within 4 minutes of each other. The loyalists had been largely blamed exclusively for that particular event, but when one does the analysis on it, one realises that the loyalists did not have the capacity to explode three car bombs within a urban area within 4 minutes of each other with that kind of precision. They had never done it before, and they didn't do it since. But the key point in relation to Dublin Monaghan is that at two meetings between the Irish Taoiseach and the British Prime Minister, the Irish Taoiseach, we know who did it. We have interned them. And for 20 years, the Irish government did absolutely nothing about it, at least nothing that we can demonstrate. And it wasn't until the Barron report was published in 2003 that we realised that we had been given that information face-to-face at a top government level. That was on the 11th of September 1974 and the 21st of November 1974. And by the way, that last day, the 21st of November 1974, was also the day of the Birmingham car bombings where the IRA had struck in the heart of Birmingham. So a lot of mayhem on both sides. But from looking at it from an Irish perspective, it is absolutely appalling, in my view, that when we were told at the top senior level that nothing happened for 20 years and we didn't actually find the truth of it until Judge Barron published his report in 2003.
Now, you have a whole section on keeping the provost in jail. And, I mean, some of these attempts at escape were quite extraordinary. I mean, helicopter escapes, people disguised as priests, battering rams at the gates of Port Leisha prison. And again, an extraordinary time, and the government facilitating the paramilitaries within the prisons by allowing them to be separate from the ordinary lags.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the chapter in the book covers the period 1972 to 1985, and it starts with the item you mentioned was the helicopter escape, I think, in October of 1973 from Mountjoy Prison. And of course, the governor in the prison at that stage had said, look, I think I'm vulnerable here and I need some protection. And the learning point for the provost, and I think there was about 160 of them in the jail at that time, was that a helicopter had been used on a previous occasion to take a loyalist prisoner who had been charged with murder on the Donegal-Derry border from the prison, so they knew it could work. Now, to keep a helicopter out of a prison, all you've got to do is to string a few wires across the open space, the exercise yard. So that was the first of it. And then, of course, there were many other attempts as well, including the escape of 19 prisoners from Port Leash. And the last one was an abortive attempt in 1985, when I think the provost had got the keys to something like 14 or 15 gates within the prison. And they had got to the final gate that would have got them out on the street in Port Leisha. They put an explosive against the door. It blew the door. It was like a wicket door patch, a small door within the larger one. And that actually jammed and they couldn't get out. Now, it was never explained how they got the explosives into the prison. And by the way, previous to that, they had shot the prison officer, Brian Stack, and he subsequently died from his wounds. So it was a very tough situation. And yes, No doubt, there was a certain amount of appeasement eventually to the provost within the prison, and they were basically running the show, if you know, from a foraging point of view within the prison. There is a book, A Man of Kerry, by Ferris, that that it recounts very easily and has some very nice photographs from the inside of the prison at that stage. But of course, 1985 was the Anglo-Irish Agreement, and then there was a change, I guess, in the political climate that the provost also, you know, kind of took their lead from at that stage.
Now, as I said, John, there's so much in this book, but you were in at the ground floor, if you like, of many of the things that have defined us over the last 50 years. The beginnings in Dublin's north inner city of the drugs trade, you saw that from the very start.
Yes, I served in Dublin's north inner city on two occasions from 1979 to 85. And then again in 1989. So in the late 70s, early 80s, the heroin epidemic was absolutely rampant within the within that area. And I'm talking about an area that you know well: Summerhill, Ballybock, North Strand, all of that area. And whole families were wiped out from the drugs epidemic. So the drugs in Dublin North Inner City is not a new phenomenon. It's just it's the same phenomenon in a different guise. It was also notable for a couple of other reasons as well. Is that there was a very high incidence of crime on the streets, what I suppose we'd call now petty crime, stealing radios from cars, which of course was used to buy to buy drugs. And it was also the time that in Sean McDermott Street at Christmas time, instead of the normal Christmas tree, they put up a tree with the names of the young men from the from that area who had perished to drugs in the previous year. So it was a very, it was very stark. But also I'd have to say this, Pat, is, and I admired people in that area very much. I mean, the women there, a lot of them traders, had fantastic spirit. They kept families together. So it wasn't all doom and gloom. Also, of course, where I was in Fitzgibbon Street was just a stone's throw from Croke Park. And in 1983, there was an infamous All-Ireland final between Dublin and Galway. And it's infamous or famous for a number of reasons. Dublin finished playing with 13 players. They beat Galway, who finished playing with 14 players. But the thing that that isn't known about it is I was on duty at the entrance to Hill 16 that particular day, which was a dirty, wet day in Dublin. And eventually, the pubs obviously were more attractive, but at very close to the kick-off time, a large crowd arrived down on that Joseph's Avenue heading towards Hill 16, and eventually they broke through the gate that had been closed in Croke Park, and that could easily have been another Hillsborough disaster. Yeah. People came out crying and so on, and eventually there's also a photograph in my book that was published in the paper at that time, and it said, "Best seats in the house," and it's myself and a number of guards who had been brought in to deal with a possible incursion from Hill 16 onto the field. So we weren't, it wasn't the best seat in the house for the match. It was the best seat in the house for dealing with the aggro from the hill. Now, look, I know we've all grown up since then, and Croke Park is managed impeccably in current times. But that particular day, it could have been another Hillsborough.
Well, John, as I said at the very beginning, there's so much in this book, we could spend the rest of the day talking about its content. Instead, I will recommend it to our listeners. It's called A Question of Honour, subtitled Politics and Policing, The Inside Story, written by retired Detective Chief and Superintendent John O'Brien. It's available if you go to www.contrarian.ie or simply call 01, a Dublin number, 254-8442, and you can secure a copy.